Okay, good afternoon. As Health Minister Tony Ryle announced earlier, Cabinet today agreed to provide $90 million towards phasing in minimum wage rates by July 2013 for disability support workers on overnight sleepover shifts. Cabinet also agreed to provide $27.5 million towards the back pay liabilities of the providers. The government will fund employers to pay 50% of the current minimum hourly wage to workers for sleepovers, dated from 1 July 2011, and then 75% from 1 July 2012, and then 100% from 1 July 2013. The government will also contribute $27.5 million for back pay, which will be paid at 50% of the appropriate minimum wage for the period 1 July 2005 until 30 June 2011 to past and present employees who have lodged a claim. The agreement, in our view, is a fair one. Idea Services and other providers are also putting in money, and I'm advised the providers are happy with the settlement. People with disabilities and their families can be assured that providing best quality support remains a top priority for the government. In terms of litigation, the three parties, the employers, unions and the Crown, have agreed not to continue litigation currently in front of the Supreme Court. The government will also introduce legislation to Parliament to secure the agreement. Jim's Rugby World Cup. The Rugby World Cup got underway on Friday night with a spectacular opening ceremony, which has drawn great reviews both domestically and internationally. It was an event which really showcased New Zealand and has been reported favourably around the world. The opening night ceremony, a match between the All Blacks and Tonga, was watched between 1.6 and 1.9 million New Zealanders, and around the world, I'm told, around about 1 billion people watched the game. I'd also like to acknowledge that on Friday there were transport issues for some people trying to get to Eden Park. Mayor Len Brown and Auckland Transport have been working hard to get on top of these issues, and Len Brown has been upfront with the media and the public about what went wrong on the night. Rugby World Cup Minister Murray McCulley and Transport Minister Stephen Joyce have been keeping close to Auckland Transport over the weekend, and they are being provided with information as soon as it becomes available. I should make it clear that we are not terribly interested in finger pointing. What we are interested is in helping Auckland fix the problems and ensuring people get to the games at Eden Park don't face the same problems again. There will be a big game on Saturday night. There's virtually a sellout crowd for Australia playing Ireland, and Sheffield is playing down at the Cloud, so it's going to be a big night for Eden Park and for the Cloud again on Saturday night. Dunedin's new stadium performed very well by all accounts, and last night's game between South Africa and Wales and Wellington, of course, was a big success. The two matches at North Harbour Stadium were played in great atmosphere, and Rotorua, Invercargill and New Plymouth did the country proud. So I think around the country we're seeing tremendous patronage at the games. As things get underway, the Rugby World Cup is certainly grabbing everyone's attention. At Queen's Wharf, people who were at the venue on Friday night found it to be an exceptional experience with great atmosphere, and people continued to visit all weekend. On Saturday, there were 30,000 visitors to Queen's Wharf, and on Sunday, there were 15,000 visitors, despite there being some pretty bad weather in Auckland on Sunday. The issues of access and crowd management at the venue on Friday night have been looked at, and the key focus now is on preparing for the weekend and making sure that those issues are resolved. Our advice from Rugby World Cup 2011 has been that as the tournament got underway and excitement lifted, ticket sales would spike up, and that's exactly what's happening around the country. There is a lot of fresh interest now, and I'm advised that sales have gone through the $250 million mark. That's a huge milestone and indicates the enormous interest worldwide in Rugby World Cup 2011. No doubt many of you have seen the international fans visiting our cities to support their teams. They're bringing great colour, great atmosphere, and they're contributing to our economy as they move around the country. So overall, the first 3 days of the Rugby World Cup have really set up for a great tournament over the next 6 weeks. Of course, I'd like to see the All Blacks top that off with a great victory, but I'll leave that in their hands. Turning to the Pacific Forum, I'd like to recap on what I think was a very successful start to the forum as we chair the next 12 months of the Pacific Forum. It was pleasing to have high-level representation at the forum with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, European Commissioner President José Manuel Barroso, and the Commonwealth Secretary Kamala Sharma all attending. Our focus going forward is on sustainable economic development, particularly in crucial sectors like fisheries, tourism and agriculture. New Zealand and our forum colleagues have committed to a number of practical measures in that area, including better maritime surveillance, the promotion of tourism opportunities and investment in education. We look forward to a productive year and look forward to passing the role of the chair in good shape to the Cook Islands in 2012. The House, as I'm sure you're aware, resumes this week and will include first readings for the Exclusive Economic Zone and Extended Continental Shelf Bill, the Natural Health Products Bill, the Student Loan Scheme Amendment Bill and the Spending Cap People's Veto Bill, the second reading of the Alcohol Reform Bill, the Road Users Charge Bill and the Crimes Amendment Act No. 2 Bill, and the third reading of the Local Government Borrowing Bill. In terms of my schedule, I'm in Wellington tomorrow and Wednesday where the House is sitting. On Thursday, I'm in New Plymouth for the day. I'm holding a bilateral meeting with the Russian Deputy Prime Minister, Alexandra Zhukov, prior to to hosting him and his delegation at the Russia versus United States rugby game that evening. The visit provides a useful opportunity for me to reinforce New Zealand's commitment to developing an FTA with Russia. On Friday, I'll be in Auckland and Hamilton. I'm looking forward to attending the All Blacks game in Hamilton on Friday night.
You say you don't want to do anything with transport issues, but whose fault is it? Who do you blame?
Well, look, that's a matter that will be fully determined when Len Brown gets a copy of that report from Auckland Transport, which he's due to get tomorrow. The Minister of Transport's had an initial briefing on that. What I can say is it catalogues quite a number of incidents that took place, some beyond people's control, others potentially not. As I say, in the end, those issues need to be resolved. Len Brown says he's totally committed to ensuring they are resolved, along with Auckland Transport, and that's good news.
Do you have confidence in them?
Look, I do. I think a bit of context has to be seen on Friday night. I mean, the first thing is 200,000 people went down to the waterfront. So, you know, I am very much a glass half full kind of guy, but even I wouldn't have predicted that many people would have gone down to the waterfront. It was just a tremendous night. It was a beautiful night. You know, the weather was fantastic. People just came out to see this spectacular fireworks show. So you had a bit of an overload there. I mean, a lot more people than they thought. There were a number of people who used trains that obviously hadn't before, and that created issues. There's a whole lot of different things that happened there, but the commitment is rock solid from Auckland to resolve it.
So how many people were expected?
I think initially they were thinking in terms of public transport about 15,000 using it, and I think 60,000 used the trains.
Apart from that issue with people pushing the emergency button, what were the other things that made the trains not
run? Yeah, quite a number, and I don't have them on me, but literally things like people jumping onto moving trains, jumping off moving trains, medical incidences. Someone actually had a major medical cardiac attack, the number of different things that went on.
So how can you stop any of that happening this week?
Well,
it seems like those are things outside of...
Yeah, some of those things, yep. And there are backup provisions for that.
And what will they be?
Well, a lot more buses.
What will the buses be close to people rather than halfway to Hamilton?
Yes,
and we can guarantee that.
Well, like I say, the responsibilities for that rest with Auckland Transport, but it's not lost on them. That some people were either very frustrated getting to the game or didn't get to the game. I think it needs to be seen in a bit of context. I mean, in the end, there's an 0800 number, as I understand it, that the Mayor has established for people who actually didn't get to the game to register, and then I guess the Mayor will make a decision what happens next. I was at the game on Friday night, obviously, and I didn't see a lot of seats that were empty when the game took place, but I don't know exactly how many people didn't make it. I understand their frustration. I was at the FIFA World Cup in South Africa when exactly the same problem happened, except our plane broke down and we actually missed the first goal. It happens in these things, but everyone accepts we need to do better and we need to deliver a world-class performance, and Auckland's committed to doing that.
The repeated thing throughout all the preparations were everyone kept asking, the transport in Auckland is going to be an issue, it's a problem. What are you doing about it? And there were repeated assurances that every contingency had been planned for.
That's right. And that is the very questions the ministers have been asking Auckland Transport, because
so
we received those assurances.
They asked those questions earlier,
yes, in my opinion.
I mean, Mark Ford was saying just a couple of weeks ago it would be taking act of God for things to fall over, and even Auckland's mayor was saying that the system would work. How could they be so wrong?
And in due respect, there are things you have to take up with Auckland Transport and with the Mayor of Auckland.
Does Murray McCulley, as the Minister responsible for the World Cup, have any responsibility for this?
Well, look, I don't want to get into a apportionment of blame. The operational control for transport in Auckland and for the activities down at the waterfront, with the exception of Queen's Wharf, are the responsibility of Auckland, as indeed they are in Wellington for the activities around transport there, as indeed they are around the country. They are the delivery agent.
Murray McCulley had the chance on Saturday morning to apologise to those affected. He chose not to. Was that the wrong call by them?
No, look, I think everyone is trying to understand what went wrong. But the important point of understanding what went wrong is to absolutely ensure it doesn't happen in the future. There'll always be some delays when you're moving so many people around a major international event, and that will always frustrate some people. But
how hard is it as if you're the minister responsible for the World Cup, and you're asked a simple question like, you apologise to people who haven't got there, and you don't?
Well, I think the point is to understand, and he certainly wasn't in receipt of that information about what went wrong at that point, and as I say, we haven't actually even seen that ourselves. We'll see those reports, I guess, when Len Brown gets them tomorrow and when the Minister gets them. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think if you just take one step back, this is the context which I would see it in. The vast overwhelming people in Auckland and around New Zealand had an amazing night on Friday night. A small group didn't, and to those people, I can completely understand their frustration. And it will be fixed.
Estimates
period.
About 2,000 people. That's not an exactly small group. Problem.
We don't know that number.
Isn't that
the Well, let's see how many people registered for the 0800 number.
You said to people to go to Party Central and you said for them to catch the train.
Yep.
And now you're saying that you're surprised that 200,000 people turned up in downtown Auckland and that the train system fell over. Those two things are.
Well, firstly, Party Central worked perfectly. Every report I've had of people that went to Party Central, which was in operational control of the government, worked perfectly.
I mean, to go down to the waterfront to kind of join in this event, the stadium at 4 million or whatever, and now it's a surprise that somehow everything fell over down.
Well, not everything fell over. Okay, so let's put a bit of context around it. Vast bulk of people got to the stadium.
When you say it worked perfectly, people couldn't get off the ferries.
Yeah, and that, again, if you go back to, there are some operational issues there, and they are the responsibility of the Auckland Council, and they are reviewing those. And again, it's part of the report.
So you blame the Auckland Council then for most of
it's not a matter
the government
of
responsible for this, Mr. Kidd?
Yeah, so the government works with its partners, and of course it's responsible. It has responsibility for the police. It has responsibility for co-responsibility for the cloud. It had responsibility for the opening ceremony. And we worked with our partners. At the end of the day, you know, what happened was hundreds of thousands of people were captured by the moment. And yep, it should have worked a bit better for the few people that didn't, and it's got to be fixed. And that in the end, that's the right course of action.
But isn't the point of appointing the Rugby World Cup Minister with that title mean that the government is taking responsibility for ensuring the event is a success?
And I think the vast bulk of New Zealanders would say it's been a success.
But the government's quick to take any glory or praise for the successes of the World Cup. Shouldn't we take the same responsibility for the failures, depending on, you know, regardless of who's technically in charge?
Yep, and I'm standing up here answering your questions.
So do you think that?
And my phone was on all weekend. I mean, at the end of the day, look, I think you've got to see it in a bit of context. If you, the people who come up to me over the course of the entire weekend have said, what an amazing night. You know, and I asked most New Zealanders what they thought of the opening ceremony. They thought it was an incredible event. You know, the vast bulk of people got to the game. So there were some small people, a small group of people that were affected by transport, and that is unacceptable. We accept that. But actually, the vast bulk of people, hundreds of thousands of people who were on the Auckland waterfront, actually had a great night.
Don't you think, though, that it's the matter of that small group of people and the amount of trauma and distress that they suffered that someone should apologise to them? And even if you weren't blamed, you are responsible.
Yeah, and as I've said to you, if somebody is has been in that category that's been affected, I 100% understand their frustration. I'd be frustrated. And at the end of the day, everything we're doing, everything within our powers, to work with our partners in Auckland to make sure there's not a repeat of it.
Does that small group deserve an apology, and if so, who should deliver it?
Well, the Mayor of Auckland and Auckland who deliver these services have apologised. Yeah, you know, I'm more than happy to apologise to those individuals involved, but at the end of the day, the responsibility rests with the delivery agent that's in Auckland. What those people really want to know is it's going to be fixed in the future, and that's very clearly what everyone's working on.
What will the government do if we have a repeat this weekend, given you say it's a big weekend for Auckland? What will you do if the system's failing?
Well, we're working on making sure it works. In the end, we work with our agents, which are Auckland.
Just to clarify, are you saying sorry to that small group?
Well, of course I am sorry that didn't work for that small group. And at the end of the day, I would have wanted them to get there and have the same experience that the vast overwhelming bulk of New Zealanders did. And that bit failed for them, and that has to be rectified. But it is being rectified. At the end of the day, in the context of what we've been dealing with, over 3 days, a lot of things went right. That bit went wrong, and it needs to be fixed. That's a matter for Auckland, the delivery agent.
Phil Gough thinks the government needs to ensure there's enough land supply in Christchurch to meet with demand for new properties to ensure there's no price spike for people buying those new properties. Do you think the government's doing enough there to ensure that there's enough properties available?
Yeah, I do, and we've raised that issue. When we were in Christchurch last weekend for the Cabinet, we had quite a number of discussions on that particular point. The Council has assured us there is a range of sections coming available, and we have the capacity under CERA to fast track that if we need to.
Because red zone homeowners are worried that the payout won't be enough to pay for property prices, yep. Properties that are on the market. Do you think that property prices will be around the level of their payouts?
It's very difficult for me to determine that because it depends on where they are, what they own, what they want to buy. There's a range of different circumstances. One thing I do know is that Christchurch is blessed as a city that it has a lot of available land. So that is the one difference, say, between Christchurch and, say, Wellington or Auckland. So yes, we need to speed that process up potentially. If we do, we can step in and we have the legislation to do it. But the assurances we've had from Christchurch is that that flow is happening quite rapidly. Now, it's a combination of making sure we work with those developers and get that right.
I think you were asked this last week, but the fear that a number of people have in Christchurch is that if that last, to get into the market, prices would have pushed up.
Yeah, so possibly anything, it might be the other way around. I mean, the flow of land and the available land, which is quite sizable, and we raised that issue with Ngāi Tahu, who's a major developer. The government itself, actually, by virtue of South Canterbury Finance, has inherited a lot of land. There's quite a number of subdivisions that are actually available there. If anything, the flow might be so great later on that the prices actually more reflect that. But there's two things that are happening. I mean, anyone in the red zone knows that they have a absolute categoric assurance from the government that they'll buy their land at rateable value, and the second buy their property at rateable value, and the second thing is the banks have indicated that they'll lend against that.
Is this your view that the insurance companies have been too cautious and dragging the chain?
It's a difficult issue, and obviously some of them are trying to deal with their risks there and what's happening in terms of their seismic activity and actually their reinsurers, but I think things are progressing reasonably well with the reinsurers in terms of the visit Jerry Brownlee's having. It's patchy, actually, when it comes to reinsurance. It's not completely clear in terms of people getting insurance. Some people can get insurance on their property. They buy another property. Other people are experiencing some difficulties. One company's trying to cash out a few people, even at above rates, to actually get them to cash out. So there's a bit of a mixture.
So what about when you say you're bothered by those reports that have some people out of pocket?
Well, it would depend on what their circumstances are, right? So again, as I understand it, there's a range of different reasons there. One is potentially, and this is the whole reason why the government's in the position it is, the government has effectively done something no other government around the world's done, and that is agreed to buy every single property in the red zone at rateable value. Rateable value is arguably, in some cases, 5% above where market value is today, and if it was buying those properties, say, even if they'd been fixed up, but in land that has been subject to such enormous seismic activity could be valued a lot lower. So we're actually buying at quite a reasonable price. The problem, I suspect, is, I'm speaking to each of the individual owners, is that the insurance companies are saying we'll pay you out on built property damage, and that is not as significant as a write-off of the land, and so they're not getting replacement value. And again, so I can understand their frustration, but actually that frustration could have been shared by up to 6,000 property owners, and the government is actually paying them all out in you know, what we're trying to make the fairest deal we can do for both the taxpayers who are paying for it and those who are receiving it. I don't have the latest update on that. I mean, what I do know is Tonkin and Taylor are moving as rapidly as they can, and what's critically important is that people get the right information, the right advice, if we're ultimately moving either someone back to green or into red. We've actually got to be absolutely sure we're right. So I know Tonkin and Taylor are going as fast as they can.
You mentioned banks being prepared to lend. Have you got any further on what happens to the freehold people who can't afford to borrow again?
Yeah, so again, there's a range of different circumstances, and that would be true of any New Zealander looking to change their property. I mean, of course, there are some people, for instance, that would be in the red zone that might want to buy out their neighbours down the road, for instance, who are effectively deemed to be in the green zone but over the road and therefore not in the red zone. So there's all sorts of options of how people might change. We had some general discussions with the council last week about what might happen to a specific group of older New Zealanders who might find it very difficult to fund themselves if there's an increase in price, and how that might work. And again, there's a range of potential solutions being worked through there.
So how might that work?
Well, I mean, it depends on the release of land and a variety of different things.
Would the government set up some kind of agency so people could go to get help with, not necessarily get insurance, but help with getting insurance and help with getting finance? So at least you get a handle of how big the problem is.
Well, our preference is to allow the private sector to work, and that's because most people have their own insurance, their own banking obligations and the likes and relationships. So our preference is for them to work through their private sector relationships. You know, if there is a major sticking point, then of course the council and the government can look at that issue, but our preference is to let the natural process take care of itself. And actually, over time it will. So even in recent weeks, some insurance issues are freeing up. Not all of them, but some are.
Some of the developers could argue it's going to be a market failure and it's time for the government to stand up.
Some people will say that, and as I say, some of that may be cured over time. Some of it the government continues to get advice on, others are freeing up. It depends.
Well, how long is the government prepared to wait while the market?
Well, the issue partly is around the capacity for people to take and assess risk while there continues to be seismic activity. And ultimately, if the government stepped in and became an insurer, it too would have to look at all of those issues.
Prime Minister, this was Mark Taylor, the terror suspect. He's called on you to put the evidence against him on the table so that he and the public can see it.
Yep.
Will you do that?
No. Look, I watched the show last night. I thought it spoke for itself.
I mean, one of the things you've said that he's under restrictions. I mean, he doesn't know what the restrictions are. What restrictions is he under and why?
I'm not in a position to go through all this.
Can the government put restrictions on someone who hasn't faced any charges?
Well, in terms of New Zealand restrictions, it's fair to say some of those have been lifted, but measures taken to ensure that the safety of New Zealanders are protected, as far as I can
see. I mean, how much of a risk is he? Because you went to the Hamilton Mosque 8 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Did you know he was there?
Yeah.
So what's the risk if you walk into a mosque where he's standing 10 metres from you?
And that was exactly the point I made when you asked me a couple of weeks ago, or a week or so ago. I said, at the moment, I don't believe he poses a risk to New Zealanders.
Because of the restrictions? Which goes like this by the restrictions.
I'm comfortable with the position as it currently sits.
I mean,
does it show though how far anti-terror laws have gone? And they've gone too far. Were you in a situation where someone who faces no charges faces these restrictions on, and you're unable or unwilling to tell us exactly what risk he supposedly poses, or you tell us he doesn't pose a risk? Why is he under restrictions at all?
Well, what I'm saying to you is he's been under restrictions in New Zealand. Not necessarily under those at the moment, but there are other measures around him. But that doesn't mean he doesn't face restrictions.
Is he free to leave the country?
Well, he has his passport returned.
I mean, what about when the passport was taken off him? I mean, how can you take a passport off someone when there's no evidence?
I'm comfortable with the actions that were taken.
Could he jump on a plane today and fly somewhere?
Theoretically.
So he's basically under surveillance.
Practically, could he?
Theoretically, yeah.
So
he's got a passport.
He could get out of the country.
Theoretically.
Are there anything attached to that passport which would prevent him from flying in a practical sense?
I'm just not in a position to document who might or might not receive him.
He says you've ruined his life. What do you say to that?
Watched 60 Minutes last night.
Just with... Can I ask about Christ?
You can go back to Christchurch, I'm more than happy to talk about
that. With those older people in Christchurch, what kind of measures could you take? Could it be selling them land that the government owns through South Canterbury Finance?
Well, I think older people are in the most difficult circumstances because they're the ones that can't necessarily fund a mortgage. But there are lots of providers out there that might want to work with them. I mean, there are reverse mortgages of sorts and things that might work their way through. People might decide, depending on their age, to make different changes. It's not necessarily clear-cut. They might have been in a more expensive house and decide to downsize in what is now actually arguably a location that has more expensive land, but their built property is less. So it's just not clear-cut.
But you're looking at ways the government could help them do that over and above ways the government's helping.
I think the way I'd characterise it is we would say we acknowledge there might be some people in that area and lots of thought is going into how they could accommodate themselves. I wouldn't necessarily say the government would provide a solution.
Would the government be putting any extra money towards helping those people or would it be extra assistance that is going to come at a cost?
I don't think so this time, but you know, we're certainly conscious that there are some people who find themselves in that category, but there are lots of people that do find themselves in a category at some point where they need to move.
Do you regret telling people in Canterbury that it would be worse off?
Did I say that exactly?
Less
I'll show me the transcript, I suppose. I mean, look, at the end of the day, this is what I think is worth putting into a bit of context. We've offered to buy every single property in New Zealand at rateable value that's in the red zone. That's above probably the market value pre the earthquake. But actually, if we just go on along after the earthquake and say, I tell you what, we'll fix up your house exactly the way it was and we'll now make you an offer for it, do you think that would have been rateable value of 2007? The answer is not a dog show. So actually, we would prefer the insurance companies take those people out, but to every single person in the red zone, we've said we'll 100% cash you out. Now, I've got to balance that against the billion-odd dollars to taxpayers that are actually paying that and say I'm doing the right thing. And I genuinely think I have the support of New Zealanders to help out those people in the red zone. But no one can get every perfect situation. I mean, it's just the nature of it. There are floods that happen around New Zealand. People have damaged their property. There's bad luck that happens to people all the time. But I think we've done, on balance, to be perfectly honest, pretty well.
Have you had any further estimates on the cost of that court case over the EQC's liability for multiple earthquakes?
No. Not a finalised number.
On a different matter, the Criminal Procedure Reform and Modernisation Bill, do you expect to make progress on that this week?
I'd like to make progress.
Do you not have the numbers to pass?
We're in negotiations with our partners.
Did you have the numbers last week? It was top of the order paper on Friday.
Well, we're in negotiations with our partners.
I noticed when you were listing the house business for this week, you didn't mention it. Does that mean it's not coming up this week?
I'm not expecting it to.
Do you view the free disclosure regime as an erosion of the right to silence?
I can understand the need for it, and I'm comfortable with the position that we've adopted, but we work in an MMP environment, and that actually means that you've got to find support of other political parties. We're a minority government.
And if you can't find that support, how acceptable is it to delegate that to a different legal body?
I wouldn't jump to that conclusion that would happen yet.
But isn't it Parliament's responsibility to make those
laws? I would have thought so.
How seriously is the government considering holding this over till after the election and just re-evaluating on the numbers?
Well, in the end, we're in negotiations. If we can't reach agreement, it'll have to be held over.
Have you had any briefing at all on the 8 Australian soldiers being investigated for drug taking?
No, I wasn't aware of that, my friend.
Do you
You said, sorry, this was Christchurch again. You said there was one insurance company trying to cash people out.
Well, there's one that I think that's been trying to slightly reduce its overall liability. It's just a bit more. Not in a position to say.
Am I?
Not in a position to say. No, it's not. Am I? Okay, well, you're good. Thanks a lot.